from St Martin in the Fields here in London, and discovering music at 5 o'clock, the composer Malcolm Arnold has gained a reputation in certain circles for light and superficial music. Charles Hazlewood delves into the world of Arnold's Fifth Symphony to reveal a work full of irony, conflict and anguish. Discovering Music is at 5. Well, it's just gone midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Shirley Williams is one of our most respected parliamentarians. She was a member of the Labour Party for 35 years before becoming a co-founder of the Social Democratic Party and later the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the House of Lords. Now, your autobiography is called Climbing the Bookshelves, and given the fame of your mother, I suppose that's rather an appropriate title. But did it have anything to do with that?
It had very little to do with my mother and everything to do with my father. My parents lived in a Georgian house, very tall, very thin, sort of 6 stories, but each one room. And they lined the whole place with bookshelves, which went very high because it was a Georgian house, high ceilings, like your own house. So the ceilings were probably between 12 and 14 feet and the bookshelves ran up them. When my brother was very young, and he was my older brother, and like all older siblings, he gave commands to his younger siblings. He used to order me to climb up the bookshelves in order to find what he called the naughty books on the top shelf. The naughty books were mostly things like Mary Stopes' Married Love and things of that kind, quite boring for a child. But I used to bring them down trustfully to my brother, and my father would sometimes come in when I was engaged in climbing the bookshelves without a ladder or anything, just hanging onto the edge of the shelves. And my father would always say, "Go on, you can make it to the top. Go on, go on." And my mother would come in and say, "Come down immediately, Shirley, or I'm going to break your arm if you fall off." And so I picked on my father's thesis, because that was really all about the aspiration that he, in a way, I think, gave me.
Of course, your mother, Vera Brittain, was an extremely successful writer, and that wasn't that common when you were young, was it, for women to have that kind of success?
People like my mother, there were quite a few authors in the 1920s and 30s who were women, you know, became quite distinguished, like Rose Macaulay and Rebecca West and so on. I think a lot of them were quite inspired by the generation or two before. Oddly enough, not quite so much by Jane Austen as by people like Charlotte Bronte and the Bronte sisters. So, and for that matter, even possibly rather less well-known people like Mrs. Hemans and so on. So what you got was a pattern of women authors looking to their grandmother's generation, really, and feeling that the one area where women could attain, and actually not without the prejudice to overcome that would go with, for example, trying to be an engineer or a doctor, that was what I think inspired them a great deal. In my mother's case, it was essentially the story of the First World War that she felt had to be told from a woman's point of view, because the war had historically been presented by the time she wrote, which was 1933, almost entirely in terms of being a men's war. And she'd seen the other side of it as a nurse, nursing in military hospitals. And that's why, together with the fact she had 4 beloved associates, brother, fiancé and so on to write about, that was what I think inspired her to write at that time.
I'm interested that we're going to start with a feeling for America, which has played quite a part in your life in some ways.
A big part. I've spent perhaps a third of my life in America. I mean, I first encountered America as a child, and I think the two compositions that really most seized me at the time, one was, of course, Dvorak's Symphony from the New World, great work about America, and the second one was the Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. One of the reasons I think I found it so attractive, as you know, is that the central theme, in a way, is a folk song, I think originally written in the Shaker community, who were great furniture makers, and they're properly called Shakers because they in some ways resembled the Quakers in many ways. They lived very simple, straightforward, truthful and honest lives. And that absolutely arresting central theme comes from a Shaker folk song, though it was later embodied in a poem by, well, a sort of song, by Hart and Crane, the famous musical composers, and from that finally back into Appalachian Spring itself. So for me, it expressed both the extraordinary kind of liveliness of America, the exuberance of America, but also quite deep down, of course, the story of the Appalachians, which is a very different story than the rest of America. It's a story of hardship and poverty and of people who made their lives, often risking their lives, mining in the mountains of the Appalachians in West Virginia. So it has a lot of bits to it that I find very attractive. Whenever I listen to that, I'm struck by the way in which both often folk song and sometimes traditional dances are the centre of a lot of composers' work. I mean, you can take something like Vaughan Williams or even Bach, for that matter, and you'll find in it the dance and the folk song and so forth. But what's so clever about it, what I think is so beautiful about that particular piece, is the way in which the composer uses that very simple theme and then transformed music until it finally ends up as almost a kind of noble statement about the building of America on the same scale as America.
Well, you're quite right, of course, because actually early music was all dance music. That was why it was there, probably dating back to when people knocked bits of stones together in the Stone Age, you know, to make a rhythm. But yes, I agree. And funny enough, it's rather appropriate for the Quakers, isn't it, that one feels the music is kind of threaded into every bit of the texture, every bit of the tapestry, as it were. So you feel it has a terrific organic sense.
And it's also very pure and very simple, which is, in a sense, I think, what Shaker and Quaker religion is.
We heard music from Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by another great American musician, Leonard Bernstein. There's, I think, Shirley Williams, actually a family connection with our next composer.
Yes, it's actually surprising. I didn't realise it was written as early as 1945. I mean, it was, in a way, part of the extraordinary spring-like renaissance of British music. It wasn't only, of course, there were people like Michael Tippett and others who came to prominence shortly after the Second World War, though Britain was an astonishingly fertile composer and he produced an awful lot of music. Two things I think about Peter Grimes. One is that having spent quite a bit of my childhood in East Anglia, it represents that extraordinary pull between these huge great skies and great pieces of land which are essentially carved out of the sea themselves, almost as they are in Holland. And secondly, the extraordinary kind of strange, misty atmosphere of that coast of Aldborough, up north from Aldborough. The other thing about it, I think that probably one of the reasons why I found it particularly personally exciting was because my mother and Benjamin Britten went together round England raising money for what was called Feed the Children, which was a movement to try to get food into Europe following the blockade during the last part of the war by the Royal Navy. So that a lot of children were desperately undernourished. And she and Benjamin Britten, both of whom, of course, had been conscientious objectors during the war, travelled around, he playing the piano, she reading from usually a Testament of Youth. They became great friends at that time because Benjamin Britten was very shy and she was obviously old enough to be his mother. And they became very close friends. And so Peter Grimes, which I think is itself an absolutely marvellous opera, astonishingly atmospheric and very, very touching, terrible story about the death of the apprentice and then the suspicions of the village directed towards Peter Grimes himself. It's extraordinarily sensitive. And I think all the way through, it's true of things like Turn of the Screw as well, that Britten has this astonishing capacity to look into men's souls and therefore to, in a sense, make the compositions much deeper than landscape compositions. They go right down to the very depth of human beings for good and evil.
And not only are the sea interludes incredible evocations of water, either being still or being in turmoil, but I would say, given what you've just said, they are, in a way, the mirror image of the troubled man.
It's a lovely way to put that, that rather like Narcissus, he looked into the pond and saw nothing but a beautiful representation of himself. I think he was a troubled man. I imagine he was partly troubled by being gay, which at that time was extremely difficult for people in public life to admit to. Partly troubled by uncertainty about his own gifts, I think, quite deep uncertainty about his own talents. And it took an awful long time, I think, for Britten to finally, if he ever did, as it were, move into the position of being the probably outstanding contemporary composer in Britain at the time. One other thing about him, that is simply that in the character of Peter Grimes, but also in the music itself, it's not only the music of the water, he also has a quite deep sense, which I think an urban-based composer would not have so readily, about the extraordinary ability to persecute that you get in small, tight rural communities. And you see Grimes being pulled apart by the suspicions of his neighbours. And then finally they're turning against him because he's an outsider and they're pushing him out. And I wonder whether that had something to do with the feeling he had for refugees, for people who were, in a sense, lost in their own communities. Because he was certainly extremely generous towards people who were outsiders in that way.
Thank you.
The Storm Interlude from Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten. And we heard there the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted, as you requested, Shirley Williams, by the composer Benjamin Britten. If Benjamin Britten owed a debt to any one composer in particular, I would say it was probably Henry Purcell, because he was completely inspired by Purcell's word setting and also the ability to get very simple emotional content into a piece of music. Are those the qualities, Shirley Williams, that have drawn you to this piece?
Three things, I think. First, for a long time I knew very little about Purcell. I suppose I probably thought of him as sort of a player of baroque trumpets, but perhaps unfair, but I sort of saw him that way. Quite wrong. When I really started working into Dido and Aeneas and The Fairy Queen and so on, I began to realise that he was an absolutely remarkable composer, not least for his time, and we're talking about the 17th century. And he also almost certainly wrote one of the, I suppose, earliest semi-operas. I think it's strictly called a semi-opera in Fairy Queen, but it was a real opera. Dido and Aeneas was a real opera too, in a way. And I think the, for me, the plaint is one of the most moving laments I think I've ever heard in music. As you say, it's very simple, but it's also extraordinarily moving and reaches sort of really deep into the sense of bereavement without being at any point sentimental and without, in a way, trying to twist the music into a kind of sentimental form. So, yes, I think that's right. And I also think, just a sort of footnote, I also found that Purcell was somebody who had not been much exported outside this country. I think now people recognise him as one of the, you know, the real, like Monteverdi, I'm one of the really great forefathers of classical music.
Music is very good because of its abstraction at times of loss, isn't it?
Yes, it bears the soul to the spirit, as it, one would say, I suppose. It's absolutely correct. And I think a lot of much more modern music slurs into sentimentality in a way that the plaint certainly doesn't. I've heard it played on one or two occasions when I've lost a close friend. And I think the sheer utter tragedy of the phrase, and I will never, 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 never see him again, it sort of says so much in so simple words. Yes, marvellous.
Ooh.
The Plaint from The Fairy Queen by Purcell. Jennifer Vivian sang The Nymph, and we heard members of the English Chamber Orchestra playing the continuo, Peter Graham, the oboe, Kenneth Heath, the cello, and Philip Ledger, the harpsichord, and Benjamin Britten was once again in charge. It's interesting how one's conception of music, like landscape, is so dictated by where one's life takes one, Germany being the next country in your case.
I went to Germany, rather surprisingly, just immediately, well, almost immediately after the war. I was invited there as a schoolgirl by the British occupation authorities, who had the very imaginative idea that it was high time to resurrect the youth movement in the Social Democratic Party, and they therefore wanted to have people of the same age, I was 17 at the time, to start this revival, to give them a sense of their contribution to the future building of Germany. And in the course of that, I remember talking to several young Germans who were deeply steeped in their own country's music, and in a way wanted to keep reminding one to take on back to the 19th and 18th centuries. I remember going to Bonn, which was infused with Beethoven memories and Beethoven music and so forth, in a way as to say, we have been a very civilised country. There was a terrible aberration, but here is some of the most beautiful music ever written. And whether it's Beethoven or Bach or Schubert, it was a feeling of going back to what Germany had been. And I think it was in a way symbolised by the fact that, of course, the capital had moved, or been moved, if you like, from Berlin to Bonn in West Germany, and Bonn being, of course, Beethoven's birthplace. And so you've got this sense of a civilisation being born again. In many ways, although Schubert lived a very short life, he was, I think, an amazingly pure composer. And there's something sort of almost luminous in the way that he writes. And the Triumph Quintet, which goes back to, you know, that earlier period of German great musical civilization, I think represents that purity better than anything else I can think of.
Thank you.
Music from Schubert's Trout Quintet, Deutsch 667. We heard part of the first movement, and the pianist was Emil Gilels. Then three members of the Amadeus Quartet provided the violin, viola and cello, Norbert Breinin, Peter Schidloff and Martin Lovett, and the double bass was played by Rainer Zeparitz. We're going to move Shirley Williams to a classic pop piece of music, but also one that has a very strong folk element to it.
A strong folk element, but also, of course, completely redolent of the decade at the end of which it was written, namely the 1960s. It was either at least published in 1970 and I think performed very shortly after that. It won the Grammy Award of the year after, 71, so it became immediately popular, part of the lexicon of popular music. It is a wonderful piece of music, I think, but one of the striking things about it, of course, is that the Bridge Over Troubled Water theme beautifully sums up that decade of the 1960s, with everything changing, everything challenged, rebellions and revolutions starting all over the place. And somehow this voice of these two beautiful singers looking, as it were, into the future and seeing A Bridge Over Troubled Waters caught the mood, I think, of their own contemporaries at that time. I'd had a very stormy 60s because I was a very junior minister of education during the great student protests, and I remember having to leap in and out of various universities in the most mysterious ways through things like central heating ducts or refrigerators, all kinds of things. It seemed a very wild time, more so in France and America than in the UK, but even in the UK it was pretty troubled. When I went to America at that time in 68, I remember being part of the great Chicago Democratic Party conference of 68 and actually having to run away from the Chicago police who'd been sent out to clear the whole of the area of hippies and yippies and other undesirable people. So one did have a feeling that suddenly the world might explode. And Simon and Garfunkel caught that with Bridge Over Troubled Waters and gave one a sense of at least some kind of peace that might be emerging from this tumultuous time.
Can't be found like a bridge over trouble. Sail on, silver girl. Sail on by. Your time has come to shine. All your dreams are on their way. See how they shine.
Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel. A great song.
It's a lovely song. Very soothing too in many ways as one lived through those tumultuous years. But the other folk song that I've chosen for this programme is one which is much older, goes back actually to something like the late 18th century, I think I'm right in saying. And it's The Keel Row by Catherine Ferrier. Now, The Keel Row was in fact the, not as I thought for a while, the name of a road, by mistake. It was actually the description of the song that was sung by people who were ferrying coal across the Tyne from one bank to the other, because the only way you could get it across, there being no bridges that could easily carry it, was by actually pushing a ferry across or pulling a ferry across. And the keel was the name of those boats that carried these heavy freights from one side of the Tyne to the other. Kathleen Ferrier was the adored singer of my parents' generation. Didn't live very long, was actually discovered to great surprise. She wasn't actually picked out until into her sort of, I think I'm right in saying, into her 30s. And then she suddenly became very quickly very widely recognised and much loved. I think she died only when she was in about her early 40s at the latest. And she became the singer of the North, Blow the Wind Southerly, many, many other folk songs from the North of England. And established them rather in the way, I suppose, one might say, that Vaughan Williams established some of the folk songs of the West Country and the South. So I wanted to play it because I went to the north of England when I was about 16 in order to find more about the other half of England. I worked there for a while and I was very struck by the directness and generosity of the people of the north. And even now, I have to admit that I have a certain bias in their direction.
Came through Sandgate, as I came through Sandgate, I heard a lassie sing. As I came through Sandgate, I heard a lassie sing. We'll lay the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll lay the keel row that my lad is in. We'll lay the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll lay the keel row that my lad is in. Oh, was like my jolly, silly, se blithe, se bonny, his form as fine the morning, he lads a comely tyne. Oh, was like my jolly, silly, se blithe, se bonny, his form as fine the morning, he lads a comely tyne. He'll sit and row so tightly, or in the dance sprightly, he'll cut a joffle slightly, tis true, were he not mine. He'll sit and row so tightly, or in the dance sprightly, he'll cut a joffle slightly, tis true, were he not mine. He wears a blue bonnet, blue bonnet, blue bonnet. He wears a blue bonnet, a dimple in his chin. He wears a blue bonnet, blue bonnet, blue bonnet. He wears a blue bonnet, a dimple in his chin. And we'll mail the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll mail the keel row that my lad is in. We'll mail the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll mail the keel row.
Kathleen Ferrier singing The Keel Row, with Phyllis Spur playing the piano. Sometimes, Shirley Williams, I must say, I feel a bit like a taxi driver when I talk to guests about other people who've been on the programme. I had that Nick Clegg in the back of the cab, that kind of feeling. But one person I did have, and I remember very vividly being very impressed by him, was Bernard Williams, your first husband, a remarkable philosopher.
And an amazing student of opera. He knew a very great deal about it. He worked, I think he actually was on E&O Council for a while, and also in Royal Opera. He played a very substantial part in trying to understand opera and wrote extensively about it. Some of the things he's written have not yet been published, but many have. I think opera was his great love next to philosophy. Indeed, the two wound round one another. And he did become extraordinarily knowledgeable of opera. His favourite way to hear music was in opera. I mean, a whole range of operas, Mozart obviously, but many others as well. Perhaps less Verdi than me. I like Verdi tremendously, but my husband had a slightly more refined taste, perhaps. And he listened, I mean, he knew a great many of the operas, Rossini and Donizetti and so forth and so on. But the next piece of music I've chosen is nothing to do with opera. It's to do with the extraordinary confidence of the Hanoverians. Whenever I hear Handel's music, I'm reminded of the extraordinary kind of solid confidence of people who could build the Hanoverian churches that one finds in London, which have this extraordinary sort of grandeur and strength, not too much subtlety and certainly very little frailty. And Handel's a bit the same. When I listen to Messiah, but also some of his other works, one feels that one is listening to somebody who knows what he believes in, where he stands, what his values are, very far away from the troubled composers like Benjamin Britten, but a man who was solid in his world and his world was solid around him. In a way, it's a great comfort to hear such music in the 21st century, because not that kind of century anymore.
Am I right in thinking that when you first came across this music, you were working in the fields?
I was working in a farm in Essex, and I briefly joined the Colchester Messiah Choir. This is back in the 1940s, actually, late 40s. And I had a difficulty because they tested my voice out for the choir. It was an amateur choir, but it was a very good one, and decided that I was probably a tenor. And so I did sing in the tenor section for quite some time.
You were working as an assistant ploughman. This is all a bit much.
An assistant cowman, actually, looking after an Ayrshire herd. And I remember I used to sort of sing Comfort Ye My People wherever I got the chance in the bathroom. I wasn't much of a bathroom, but the next best thing. So I've always loved Messiah, but the particular reason for choosing How Beautiful Are the Feet was much more to do with my mother, because she was, as it were, a pacifist, because she had become a great voice of the peace movement in the years after the, before and after the Second World War. And of course, it goes on to teach the gospel of peace. This particular piece of the Messiah, to me, speaks to me a great deal about my mother, whereas I suppose it would be fair to say that opera would have spoken to me more about my first husband.
Emma Kirkby sang How Beautiful Are the Feet from Handel's Messiah with the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Christopher Hogwood. Finally, Shirley Williams, you've had so much to say about music, we've not actually talked about politics at all, which is probably quite a nice relief for you. However, I can't help asking you, as somebody who was a member of the Labour Party for so long and then started the SDP, along with Bill Rogers and David Owen, and then as a Liberal Democrat peer, I can't help wondering how you view the incarnation of a kind of new party now, really, in order to make the voting mean something, we end up with a coalition.
Oh, I think, Michael, I have to say that precisely not a new party. I mean, when I was in Liverpool, some kindly Liberal Democrat had actually produced a button for people to wear. And the button was based upon a remark I'd made to when I was asked by a BBC questioner, how do you feel about being in bed with the Conservative Party? And I said, not in the same bed, two beds. And that's the way I feel. And so a single party, no. And I think it'll probably never be a single party. Quite straightforwardly, I mean, I'm a Social Democrat. I always have been. I haven't very much changed from that position over my whole lifetime. But the thing that I think made me feel, in a way, obliged to support the coalition, and I don't pretend that it was a natural place for me to be at all, was essentially seeing something of what was happening in the United States, where a similar crisis on a similar scale, on a huge scale, had led to total polarisation in politics, the most bitter conflict between a Republican Party that would simply not help the president at all to get any legislation through, any new policies through, including even things like the revival of the economy itself, things like the health proposals, things like the, believe it or not, the disarmament proposals by agreed between the American and Russian governments called START 2. On all of these things, the opposition simply dug its heels in and has actually made governing almost impossible. And then on the other side, you had Democrats who were no longer able to speak to Republicans. And then on the far right, you had the Tea Party making things even worse. So I think I came to the conclusion that this was a big enough crisis, not only the economic crisis, but also the political crisis that blew up around expenses and the loss of trust in Parliament itself, to actually justify parties having to work together. And I was comforted in a way when actually one or two former members of the Blair administration were brought into the coalition, Alan Milburn for one, in order to take part in this process. We're not close to having Labour people coming in and helping and supporting. And somebody might say that's kind of close to a national government. Well, I'd be totally against the national government in a normal peacetime period. But I think many people don't recognise just how really critical the situation is and how one simply has to get away from Punch and Judy politics. And I think we're doing that.
And of course, this idea of having a slight break on things is not so uncommon in Europe, is it?
No. I mean, I think you can't be in favour of PR and believe you'll ever live in a world which isn't made up of coalitions. And when you look at the remarkable success, although it's had a lot of differences, of the German coalition under Angela Merkel, one can see that when it comes to political issues that require long-term answers rather than short-term answers, whether they're future of the National Health Service or whether they're issues to do with economic investment, one has to get away from everything being subject to the most sort of sharp and polarised politics. And I think that's what we will be able to do.
Shirley Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shirley Williams was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week, at the same time, Michael's guest will be the comedian and actress Arabella Weir. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Sarah Cropper.
As Mahler's anniversary year continues, BBC Radio 3 brings you a rare chance to hear Mahler's Beethoven. In Performance on 3, members of the London Philharmonic will play the Eroica, as reorchestrated by Mahler for what he saw as modern halls and modern instruments. A rare chance to hear two great symphonists combine. Beethoven's Eroica, through the eyes and ears of Mahler. Performance on 3, Wednesday night at 7 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, and on digital radio and also online. It's 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The authorities in Yemen say they're looking for more suspects in connection with two bombs which were found on flights heading for the United States. The packages were intercepted on Friday in the UK and in Dubai. A female student has been arrested and is being questioned. Qatar Airways has said the bomb, which was found in Dubai, had been carried from Yemen on two of its passenger flights. American officials have said there's no specific indication that there are any more parcels linked to this plot, but extra precautions had to be taken. Here, the Home Secretary, Theresa May, has said the handling and screening of all air cargo coming into Britain will have to be reviewed. Unaccompanied freight from Yemen has already been barred. Mrs. May said it was also important to keep up strict checks on passengers at UK airports. She said the bomb, which was discovered at East Midlands Airport, could have gone off at any time and could have brought down the plane which it was on. A bomb which was found at Belfast International Airport has been made safe. It had been left in a vehicle in a long-stay car park and is believed to have contained a flammable liquid. Police say another device was found in Lurgan on Friday and they've urged the public to be vigilant. In a statement, the Police Service of Northern Ireland said misguided individuals and groups were trying to drag the country back to mayhem and misery. 22 people have been injured in Turkey in what police think was a suicide bombing. The explosion happened in a central square in Istanbul. A bomb disposal team has discovered further suspect devices nearby. Cricket's governing body, the ICC, has upheld the suspensions of two Pakistan players who were accused of taking part in a betting scam. Mohammed Amir and Salman Butt have denied deliberately bowling no balls in a test against England. The allegations are still being investigated. And the weather, it'll be cloudy with showers across much of the UK this afternoon. It'll become dry in Northern Ireland and Scotland with some sunshine in western parts of Scotland. That's the BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one. And it's time now to join Catherine Bott for the Early Music Show, which today focuses on one of Vivaldi's best-known stage works.
Antonio Vivaldi once claimed to have written 94 operas, but fewer than 50 titles have been identified, and only 20 or so scores actually survive. Today, we're taking a look at one of those stage works, Orlando Furioso. I'm not going to follow the story through in order, although I will give you some idea of the convoluted plot a bit further in, but I'm aiming to give a flavour of the piece, aided by the insights of a singer who was involved in a complete recording of it, French countertenor Philippe Jaroussky. So, take your seat in the opera box and enjoy the breath-catchingly hectic overture to the opera that Vivaldi labelled a heroico-magical drama, Orlando Furioso.
Thank you.
overture to Vivaldi's opera Orlando Furioso, played by Ensemble Mathieus, conducted by Jean-Christophe Spinozzi. Here are the statistics. Orlando Furioso, Orlando in a Frenzy, was first performed in Venice in 1727. The libretto is by Grazio Braccioli, based on an epic poem of the same name from the year 1516 by the Italian poet Ariosto. Braccioli chose some of the exploits in Ariosto's poem to create the drama in the stage work. The real Orlando was Roland, an 8th-century military leader who served the Frankish warrior king Charlemagne. And his story is told in a huge, sprawling, 46-part poem of Christians versus Saracens, sorcery and seduction, secret weddings and concealed identity. You know the sort of thing. Grist to the mill of 18th-century opera composers. But I'm going to try to summarise the plot anyway. It'll sound a bit like the opening of an episode of Round the Horn, but the landscape of Operatopia is well worth a visit. Here goes. The action takes place on an enchanted island, home to old, hideous, deceitful sorceress Alcina. Brought to its shores by operatic fate are the famous Christian knight Orlando, who loves the fair Angelica, princess of Cathay, who has disappeared on the voyage. Sadly for him, Angelica, who hasn't done anything of the sort, of course, is herself in love with a humble Saracen hero, Medoro, and at curtain up, it seems he has been lost at sea. Another Christian knight, Ruggiero,